On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
To begin with, Congress should act to make sure no one on a no-fly list is able to buy a gun. What could possibly be the argument for allowing a terrorist suspect to buy a semi-automatic weapon? This is a matter of national security. We also need to make it harder for people to buy powerful assault weapons, like the ones that were used in San Bernardino. I know there are some who reject any gun safety measures. But the fact is that our intelligence and law enforcement agencies, no matter how effective they are, cannot identify every would-be mass shooter, whether that individual is motivated by ISIL or some other hateful ideology. What we can do, and must do, is make it harder for them to kill.
The president speaking from the Oval Office last night. Polls show a significant majority of Americans support universal background checks. But last Thursday, the day after the San Bernardino shootings, the Senate voted down a universal background check bill. The Senate also voted down a measure to stop people on the terrorist watch list from being able to buy guns. A few Republicans joined the Democrats supporting background checks, but the votes were largely along partisan lines. So now the president is considering taking some kind of executive action on gun control. Joining me to discuss that is Adam Winkler. He's a constitutional law professor at UCLA and author of the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what kind of executive action is the president considering?
Well, the main thing is an executive action that would redefine who counts as someone who needs to get a firearms dealer's license. So the way we have our background check system is if you want to buy a gun and you go to a federally licensed dealer, he has to conduct a background check. But if you buy a gun from a private seller, they don't have to conduct a background check. His proposal will probably be to expand the background checks a little bit to get more people who are currently thought of as private sellers to really be counted as licensed dealers, people who need a license to sell a gun and have to conduct a background check.
How hard will it be for him to do that?
I don't think it'll be very difficult. The law is somewhat ambiguous. It says you have to get a federal license if you are engaged in the business of selling firearms. It's up to the executive branch to define what that exactly means. Is it you sell 5 guns a year, 20 guns a year, someone who makes $1,000 a year selling guns, $10,000 a year selling guns? It's inherently ambiguous, so the executive branch has the authority to interpret that ambiguity. And so I think he'll be able to do that relatively easy.
So would this essentially do the same thing that the Senate didn't do in terms of its voting down bills for universal background checks?
Absolutely not. This would be a very, very, very small expansion of the background check system. What President Obama proposed in the wake of the Newtown shooting back in 2012, 2013, was to expand background checks to make them universal, to basically eliminate the idea that you could buy a gun from a private seller who wouldn't have to do a background check. That would be much different than what we're talking about here, which is a really very small adjustment.
What about what he said in that clip of tape where he wants to limit the ability to buy certain assault weapons?
Well, that has been one of the major items on the top of the gun control agenda for several years. It was part of his post-Newtown proposals, too. There's certainly not going to be much federal will for such legislation. We have seen such legislation, though, passed in a variety of states and some cities, and so we may see more action in that area on assault weapons.
Right. In fact, a case coming out of Illinois, the Supreme Court today refused to hear a challenge to that. I believe Highland Park has banned certain assault weapons, and the Supreme Court refused to hear a challenge to that. What does that
tell you? That's right. The lower court upheld the ban, so the ban remains in place, and the court refused to step in and interfere. It suggests, though, that really the biggest problem for gun control advocates is not the courts. The courts have upheld the vast majority of gun control laws. It's the electoral process. It's the elected branches. That's where gun control advocates have had the most struggle.
Except when you look at the court, there was the famous 2008 Supreme Court decision that said for the first time the Second Amendment protects an individual's right to bear arms. I think this was a handgun case. So what did that decision do in terms of gun control?
Well, I think as people are seeing from today's inaction by the Supreme Court, that maybe it didn't do nearly as much to inhibit gun control as some in the gun rights community might have hoped. The court did say you have an individual right to bear arms, but also made clear that most forms of gun control are constitutional. And since the court's two major gun decisions back in 2008 and 2010, the court has turned down case after case after case, raising important Second Amendment questions. It may be that since Newtown, in the same way that the gun debate more generally has been changed, maybe some of the opinions of some of the justices have been changed too, and they're having some second thoughts about the scope of the Second Amendment.
So does this mean then that gun control advocates should look towards states and localities for any kind of action, because it just seems that nothing is going to happen on a federal level in Congress?
Well, as long as pro-gun forces are in control of the House, as they're expected to be even after the next election, we shouldn't expect any significant new federal legislation. And President Obama has pushed the envelope on executive action, and there's just not a lot he can do. He can only tinker at the margins. So gun control advocates are certainly looking to the states and sometimes the courts through lawsuits to try to advance the cause of gun control.
Okay, so looking at what the public wants, is Congress in line with what the public wants or not?
Congress, well, it's very difficult to know exactly what the public wants. There are some new polls out that you referenced that show stronger support for gun control this week than we've had in the last few months and maybe even the last few years. But the polling data is sort of all over the map. Support for gun rights is very strong. While it's true we had 90% of the people polled said they supported universal background checks, but you couldn't even get 60 votes in the Senate. So clearly there's some disconnect.
Right. And then you saw so many people going out to buy guns after the tragedies in Colorado and in San Bernardino.
That's right. Black Friday, the major day where we have sales of so many items, saw the most gun sales as determined through background checks that we've ever seen. Over 180,000 background checks run on Black Friday alone. Clearly, there's a lot of people who are finding some solace in firearms.
Adam, great to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
Adam Winkler, a constitutional law professor at UCLA. And we'd love to hear from you. Do you think the president should take executive action on guns? And how important is this issue to you as a voting issue? Will it help you decide whom to vote for in the presidential race? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can reach us on Facebook and Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Well, in his speech last night, the president mainly focused on the fight against ISIS. But he made it clear this is not a conventional conflict. Here's the president talking about tactics.
We should not be drawn once more into a long and costly ground war in Iraq or Syria. That's what groups like ISIL want. They know they can't defeat us on the battlefield. ISIL fighters were part of the insurgency that we faced in Iraq. But they also know that if we occupy foreign lands, they can maintain insurgencies for years, killing thousands of our troops, draining our resources, and using our presence to draw new recruits.
Well, if that's true, what should we be doing instead to combat jihadists in Syria? And how effective can we be with airstrikes and proxy forces? Andrew Tabler is a fellow at the Program on Arab Politics at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, also author of the book Inside the Lion's Den, an eyewitness account of Washington's battle with Syria. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
Well, is the president correct when he says that sending U.S. troops would be just playing into ISIS's hands?
Of course, it would depend on how many and where. What's strange is that I don't, for the course of the Syrian war, most advocates of doing more in Syria didn't advocate sending troops. It's only with the advent of ISIS and the idea that they have to be completely physically destroyed has the idea of sending large contingents of ground forces in come to the fore. It's true, ISIS does want that. They do want to fight us directly on the battlefield. Unless we can find someone else to defeat them, I'm afraid that's probably the situation we're going to be in as the Obama administration winds down and we move into the next administration.
You think that there will be a ground war eventually?
I don't understand how ISIS is defeated, how ISIS is ripped out of eastern Syria and the areas in which it exists without some more assertive Western military presence. I do, though, think that we would be much better off dealing with local forces, which the president talked about in the second point of his address last night, because of the costs of dealing with this directly and the chances of a long-term insurgency.
So local forces, which we're doing now in terms of working with Kurdish groups, Peshmerga, PKK, YPJ, YPG, rather, and these groups are being supported chiefly through U.S. airstrikes, and they're pretty effective now and then. But what about other areas where the Kurds aren't interested in, Sunni-dominated areas like Mosul and Raqqa?
Well, that's a very good question. So Kurds have the advantage of being anti-ISIL, but have limited range due to numbers. The idea is to get what they call the Syrian Democratic Forces, some Arab forces, to bandwagon with the Kurds in eastern Syria to defeat ISIL. They only have about 5,000 fighters, though, so we're talking about some pretty limited numbers. But at the moment, the administration's focus on the train and equip of local forces is, in case of Syria, focused on that particular group. They're low in numbers. They have traditional animosities with the Kurds, but the administration is, I think, trying to play a pretty weak hand as best they can, because their earlier program to train and equip the moderate rebels in Syria failed because of the administration's unwillingness to make a clear decision on President Assad and his role in a transition in Syria.
Right. So where are we on that in terms of dealing with Assad and trying to get him out of power? And what is the strategy now? It used to be, opposing Assad. And now it seems that maybe there's some wiggle room.
Well, the United States is still adamant that President Assad has to go as part at the end of the process. The modalities, when he goes, how he goes, is another matter. They say that the Russians realize they're stuck in a quagmire and need to get out of it, and therefore will make some concessions. The problem is, I don't think that's the clear answer that the Russians are giving, and certainly the Iranians are not giving that. And so I think at the moment the negotiations are trying to see what is possible, but will they be able to do anything? Who knows?
So ISIS has become enemy number one in Syria, not Assad?
Well, I think we're sort of caught between the equal of two bads. We have ISIS and the atrocities that it's been carrying out in the attacks on the one side. And then on the other side, we have Assad, whose failed attempt to bomb Scud missile, gas, and barrel bomb his way out of his insurgency has left him only in control of about a quarter of his territory. So it's a sort of battle between the evil group that filled up the vacuum and the dictator that created the vacuum in the first place. And that's a pretty difficult situation to be in. ISIS, of course, is the most important issue politically. But a lot of those who have been dealing with the ISIS threat who have recently retired have been openly saying in many forums that you can't deal with ISIS and defeat it unless you come up with a viable settlement in the Syrian war. And that remains elusive as till now.
Yeah. And so, speaking politically, have you heard any good ideas from the Republican candidates at all in terms of combating ISIS or, dealing with Assad?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I listen to all the candidates and some of them have some I think that they have the right ideas in terms of Assad has to go. He has to go in some way. The question is, how do you do that? And of course, that's not going to be their responsibility because they would not take over for, over a year. Mm-hmm. The question, I think, is goes just beyond that. This war, even if there was a diplomatic agreement tomorrow, such an agreement would take years to implement. It's going to run well into the next administration. What are we going to do in the humanitarian sense? What are we going to do concerning migrants, refugees, terrorist threat? Unfortunately, until now, ISIS is a bit like a balloon. You squeeze it in one place and it pops out somewhere else. And until we get out of that dynamic, you know, and realize we can't bomb our way out of it, I'm afraid we're going to be a bit stuck.
Was there a point in the last few years where things could have gone a different way had the president acted differently? I mean, he is criticized for not being as assertive as he could have been, possibly. You mentioned arming rebel groups. Was there a turning point that the U.S. just missed?
Absolutely. There were two that were enormously damaging. One was, you first mentioned, the decision to arm. The subset of that decision was that we allowed our allies in the region to arm the rebels instead, which took us out of the equation largely and allowed them to support groups inside the country that we did not support. The second enormously damaging decision, very controversial, probably will be the most controversial decision of the Obama presidency in terms of foreign policy, is what is known in the government as the non-strike incident of 2013, or the popularly laying down a red line and walking away from it. After that, the people all over, Sunnis in particular, all over Syria, ran over to the extremists. And that wouldn't be a problem, but Sunnis are by far the majority in Syria. And it was a close call for the president, but a bad call politically for trying to deal with ISIS. And we now have the situation we have as President Obama leaves the presidency.
Andrew Tabler, fellow in the program on Arab politics at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Coming up, the Supreme Court is considering two major cases this week, one involving redistricting, another about affirmative action. They are both brought by one man who also brought the recent successful challenge to the Voting Rights Act. Who is Ed Blum? That's next on Press Play.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It is a big week at the Supreme Court. Tomorrow, the justices will hear a case that could redefine what we mean when we call ourselves a representative democracy. And on Wednesday, there's a case that takes on affirmative action at the college level. Behind both of these blockbuster cases is one guy, conservative activist Ed Blum, recruited plaintiffs and lawyers to bring lawsuits in both of these cases. Blum is also behind landmark lawsuits that overturn longstanding rules about voting rights. Well, joining me now to find out more about Ed Blum is David Ganz, director of the Human Rights, Civil Rights, and Citizenship Program at the Constitutional Accountability Center in Washington. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So let's talk about the case the court is going to hear tomorrow. This is the redistricting case?
Yeah. So tomorrow the court will be hearing the case of Evanwell versus Abbott, which is perhaps the most important redistricting case that's been heard since the tenure of the Roberts Court. And really, it's an attack on the idea of equal representation for all people. Sue Evanwell, who is the Republican county chair in Texas, is urging the court to start a real revolution and radically change the way states and local governments draw election districts. Right now, around the country, when states draw election boundaries, they count all persons, whether they're a voter or not. Based on a fundamental principle in our Constitution that looks at the total population, that ensures everyone counts and that everyone is a constituent that receives representation. But Evanwell says that the Constitution requires that states draw lines based only on the number of eligible voters. And that would take away representation from children, from many immigrants who are not naturalized, and from others who lack access to the ballot. So this is really kind of a frontal assault on this basic principle that really goes back to the very founding of the country that calls for sort of equal representation for equal numbers of people.
And how is Ed Blum connected to that case?
So Ed Blum is not a lawyer, and he's sort of unique in that he's not the one arguing the case, but he's behind the scenes. He He provides financing for the case. He helps recruit lawyers to argue cases that he's interested in pushing, and he finds plaintiffs. So he works behind the scenes to get cases before the court that will move the law to the right on issues of race and voting.
And speaking of, the court is also hearing this week the Fisher case, and this is an affirmative action case. The court already heard this case, so why is it hearing it again?
Well, right. So if you remember, 2 years ago, Bloom sort of came on the scene with the Fisher case as well as the Shelby County case, which struck down the a key portion of the Voting Rights Act. And Fisher was billed as a case that would really radically limit the ability of universities to select a diverse student body that looked at all facets of an individual, including racial diversity. That case resulted in a 7-1 opinion that said, let's send this back to the lower courts for a second look. The lower courts did that, and they once again upheld the University of Texas's plan, which really is very similar to the kinds of plans that have been upheld by the Supreme Court for many years now. And the Supreme Court, at the end of last term, once again said, we're going to hear this again. And so, you know, we're back, and this is kind of the next chapter in what has been a long-running campaign of conservatives to strike down laws and policies that use race to foster equality, even though the framers of the 14th Amendment were the originators of affirmative action. And many of Bloom's cases are motivated by this idea, which really doesn't have any basis in the 14th Amendment's history.
Right. So he has been remarkably successful in getting cases before the Supreme Court. I mean, usually they only hear fewer than 1% of the cases filed. And yet he's had, what, at least 3, maybe 4 cases heard in the last several years?
He has been successful. I mean, so, and I think some of that is connected with, you know, the current court and the rise of the Roberts Court. And in many ways, you know, you look at the jurisprudence of John Roberts, and it is very similar in a number of respects to the argument Bloom is making. And so, you know, you look back to 2007, one of the first, you know, big cases written by Roberts, in which he writes just for 4 justices, arguing that the way to stop racial discrimination is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. And so argues for a sort of absolute rule of colorblindness, and Kennedy sort of refuses to sign on and says, no, you know, government can act to counter racial isolation, and they can counter to ensure equality of opportunity for all persons regardless of race. And that sort of fight, you know, has continued. You know, in Fisher, Kennedy wrote this very narrow opinion that said, look, policies like this can help break down stereotypes, which can help further the goal of equality, and as long as they're properly tailored, they're consistent with the Constitution, which is what Supreme Court precedent has long said. You know, now they are kind of grappling with these questions once again.
Mm. So what is it about Ed Bloom and his ability to get these cases before them? Is he able to just pick perfect plaintiffs who make a compelling argument?
So some of it is he's finding cases that correspond to the area where Roberts and some of the other conservatives would like to move the law to the right. So you could see that in a case like Fisher, where there's no— usually when the Supreme Court hears a case, it's because there's a division in the lower courts. Here there's no division, but it's a case where I think Roberts and others want to move the law to the right to make it harder for universities to use race to foster diversity on their student bodies. Similarly with the Voting Rights Act, that act had been upheld 4 times by the Supreme Court, but it was something that Roberts you know, disliked, dating back to his tenure at the Reagan Justice Department. And he was kind of, you know, known as a very bitter opponent of the Voting Rights Act. And this case was a chance, you know, for him to, you know, deal a blow to the act's— one of the act's most important sections that had helped millions of Americans exercise the right to vote. Evanwell that the court is hearing tomorrow is a little different in that Bloom tried a similar case involving a similar issue a number of years ago, but on a local level. And he lost in the lower courts. And the Supreme Court said, we're not going to review it. And he came back with the Evanwell case, which is a challenge to Texas legislative redistricting. And if you bring a case that challenges that, there's an automatic appeal from the trial court to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has much less ability to say we're not interested in this case. So I think he used some procedural tactics that made it a better vehicle to get before the court. And you know we're going to see tomorrow this sort of this mm-hmm. face-off, this attack on the idea of equal representation, and whether Bloom's team can convince the Supreme Court to be the first court in American history to go far and say that we decide representation based not on counting everyone, which is our constitutional tradition and is kind of reflected in the actual text of the Constitution, but based only on the number of voters, which was, interestingly, there's kind of a sort of a lost part of 14th Amendment history, which is that this issue, counting the total population and ensuring equal representation for all versus only counting voters, was debated quite passionately for months during the debates over the 14th Amendment. And at that time, the framers reaffirmed the rule that everyone is counted and everyone is represented.
All right, we have to wrap it there. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. That's David Ganz, Director of the Human Rights, Civil Rights, and Citizenship Program at the Constitutional Accountability Center. Well, we would like to know from you what you think about Ed Bloom and how he brings cases before the Supreme Court. Liberal groups have done the same thing, finding the perfect plaintiff for their cases. Leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can comment on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, author Michael Cunningham has indulged in a desire he has had since he was a little kid, picking up where Happily Ever After leaves off.
My reworkings of these fairy tales are a kind of homage. These are not sort of wised up postmodern mm-hmm. sneerings at these tales. They come very much from my love of these tales.
The delightful and disturbing reworking of classic fairy tales after a news update with Jennifer Wolfe.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. There's not a whole lot of room in the classic fairy tale for moral ambiguity. Be good and good things will come to you. Happily ever after, right? Well, not really. That's not how life works. So why then do we treat fairy tales as moral allegory, as guides for how to live a righteous life? Well, enter Michael Cunningham's new collection of reworked fairy tales. The author of novels like The Hours and By Nightfall has taken stories like Beauty and the Beast, Rumpelstiltskin, and Hansel and Gretel and injected them with a bit of reality. The collection is called A Wild Swan and Other Tales. Michael Cunningham is here now. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with one of your fairy tales that reimagines Jack and the Beanstalk. It's called Jacked.
Yeah.
Which is kind of funny. And you modernize it. And Jack mm-hmm. is kind of a jerk.
Jack is kind of a jerk. Yeah. Yeah. Well, my reworkings of these fairy tales are a kind of homage. These are not sort of wised up postmodern mm-hmm. sneerings at these tales. They come very much from my love of these tales. And what I wanted to do, as you said so succinctly in your introduction, was to just sort of look into the corners a little bit, question some of the morality. And we have to, Jack, the original Jack in the Jack and the Beanstalk before I got to it, has been told by his mother to please sell the family's sole remaining asset, the one thing that stands between them and eviction and starvation, a cow. They're only cow, their last cow, not a promising or prize cow, but still their last cow. And what does he do? On his way to town, he sells the cow to a stranger for 6 magic beans. That looks like jerk to me.
Or just dumb.
Or just dumb. My Jack is that guy that, you know, that the guy who spends half his salary on lottery tickets. That guy who thinks his garage band is gonna be discovered and signed to a major label and doesn't even realize that major labels don't exist anymore. It's that guy.
Yeah.
That's my Jack.
He's kind of lovable and kind of not.
Well,
because he does. He does.
Okay. Who do you know who's not
a lot of people like that?
Who's not a lovable kind of not? I include myself.
Everybody. but he's also kind of a trickster, too. I mean, mm-hmm. He's smarter than the initial anecdote about the beans would have him be.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because he's tricky.
He's cagey. The way a wastrel and a flake sort of needs to be. I mean, you may not be sort of quote unquote technically intelligent, but you got to be wily.
Yeah. And so he kind of convinces, well, he does convince. He convinces the giant's wife to help him out, give him some gold and stuff behind the giant's back. And what I like about this story is how you imagine the relationship between the wife and the giant.
Well, that was really the heart of this particular retelling of this particular story. When I went back and read Jack and the Beanstalk again, I remembered having it read to me when I was, I don't know, 6 or 7 by my mother or my father, and wondering at 6 what I wonder at, shall we say, rather older than 6, over the fact that Jack climbs up the beanstalk, there is this castle in the clouds, and knocks on the door, the giant's wife lets him in. Perfectly understandable. Hey, cute little mini dude, come on. He robs the giant, the giantess's husband, of his gold. That's a bummer. Gets away. After a while, you know, Jack feels like there can always be more, and he goes back up the beanstalk, knocks on the castle door. The giant's wife lets him in again. And you have to ask, whether you're 6 or 106, which I will soon be, what is going on in that marriage? What is that about? Why would any wife let the man who robs her husband in a second time? It does not defy credibility, but it begs explanation.
So what's the answer? Does she really hate her husband?
You know, it's a little more complicated than that. You know, I like so many novelists, I'm slightly geekily in love with complication. You know, the writer is often the person who sits down in the middle of the discussion says to everyone's irritation, no, it's not that simple. It's more complicated than that. The way I depict the marriage, it was one of those fatally okay marriages. It's neither terrible nor great, and she is sort of looking for evidence against him. She's looking for a reason to feel justified in leaving him, and she can't quite bring herself to leave him, and so she identifies with Jack, who is rapacious and brutal and can steal from her husband the way she would like to steal from him by leaving him.
Wow. That's intense. You just imagine that.
I'm intense, right?
Yeah. That's more than the Brothers Grimm imagined.
I mean, I don't look like it when I walk in the room.
Well, speaking of intense and relationships, let's talk about how you reimagine Snow White. This is, you call it Poisoned.
Yeah.
And she and her prince they've gotten together. They've lived, this is post living mm-hmm, happily ever
mm-hmm,
after.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the next scene. And he's got a little bit of a fetish.
He does. This is a bit of a spoiler, but I don't think a fatal one. Yeah. You know, one of my questions as a child and as an adult is, what happens happily ever after when my parents would read these stories to me and we would get to, and they lived happily ever after, I would look at them like, go on. And they'd say, no, the story's finished. I said, no, they can't be finished. What is happily ever after? Forever? What? So, yeah, we pick up on Snow White and the Prince. It's not a bad marriage. It's actually kind of a good marriage. You know, they have their moments, but they're pretty happy together. And we learn about midway through the story that the prince has come to fetishize that first kiss when he was riding his steed through the forest, came upon the seven dwarves, came upon the beautiful maiden in the glass casket, and kissed her and brought her back to life. And since then, things have been good, but there's been nothing like that first moment when she opened her eyes and they were both endless possibility to each other. And so he makes her enact it every single night.
Wow. And she's kind of over it and she's...
She's a loafer.
She's kind of sick of it.
often the case in couples that practice various fetishes, sometimes one member begins to lose enthusiasm before the other. I only know the second hand, of course.
So a lot of these stories are really about relationships then. They're about these relationships that don't end happily ever after. There's more complications.
Again, I don't want to I've probably used up my day's allowance of the word complications. But yeah. It's not that they live unhappily ever after. It's that they live complicatedly ever after, which is pretty much how we live.
Yeah. So is that why you wanted to take on the fairy tales, that you wanted to dismantle the happily ever after?
Oh, that's one of the reasons. You know, I wanted to look more deeply into them. As you said earlier on, they tend to be fairly simple moral tales, and there's nothing wrong with a simple moral tale. We can use simple moral tales, especially when we're incorrigible children, like some of us were. But I wondered about not only the motives of somebody like the giant's wife and Jack and the Beanstalk. What's it like after Snow White and the Prince go to the castle and get married? But also, it's funny. On one hand, fairy tales are often, not always, but often sort of simple moral tales. On the other hand, they're all about sex and death.
Yeah.
You know?
And they're violent.
Beauty and the Beast is practically pornography.
Well, let's talk about that one. You reimagine that one. It's called Beasts. And in that one, the beast really is a beast.
Well, various depictions of Beauty and the Beast, from the incredibly beautiful Jean Cocteau silent movie to Disney's Beauty and the Beast, both of which I like.
Yeah.
There's certainly a sense in the Cocteau, and to me a little bit in the Disney as well, that the prince, once the beast has been transformed into a prince, is a little bit of a disappointment. You know, the beast was more interesting.
That a girl always wants a little beast.
A girl wants a little
smidgen
beast.
Of beast.
Yeah. And as I sat with that story and thought about that, I thought, right, you'd sort of rather be with the rough guy than the nice guy. But I kind of wanted to look at that and look at our sort of collective idealization of the beast, a.k.a. Stanley Kowalski, a.k.a. any big lug who's kind of sexier than that nice guy. And I thought to myself, have you ever dated a beast? Have you ever dated somebody who's really messed up? I felt that anybody who has had a relationship with this sort of brutal, sexy fantasy figure probably has other ideas about the appeal of the beast.
Yeah. Have you?
I wouldn't say.
Maybe you're the beast.
Never.
The last story, though, kind of contradicts everything that you've said.
Well, the last story is the only one that I invented. It's not based on any existing story. I hope it doesn't contradict everything I've said, because the I guess it's 10 stories that have preceded it have ended variously, happily and less happily. You know, there's a range. You know, a few of them actually end quite well. The Steadfast Tin Soldier. Couple of them.
It's rough along the way with that one, though.
But hey, who trusts a happy ending that just arrives, you know, like fruit of the month? I mean, a happy ending is only meaningful if it has survived something bad, if you've come through the darkness into the hope.
Well, that's true of everything, right?
Any accomplishment. You know, you don't want to hear a story about how everything went just fine and then got even better. So I think a happy ending is all about surviving adversity and getting to happiness. And I do love fairy tales. I wasn't setting out to mock them in this book. I thought I want to end it with a more regular fairy tale.
With a happy ending.
With a happy ending. But even in that story, the happy ending is not easily reached, is not perfect, is not without its blemishes and its dark little corners. But having been so equivocal and you know, happy but unhappy, yes but no, look at human nature and its incredible contradictions, I thought, let's just leave everybody with a happy one.
Well, Michael Cunningham, it's been so much fun speaking with you and talking about fairy tales.
Likewise. Thank you for having me.
Michael Cunningham, his new collection of stories is called A Wild Swan and Other Tales. Well, a happy beginning to the work week for you, Warren Almy.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the happy beginning. The story we have to tell isn't as happy as I'd like it to be. We're going to take a long look at the president's speech. Did the White House create expectations it couldn't fulfill by suggesting that he might have something actually new to say about either lone wolf attackers in the United States or the options available in the Middle East? It doesn't seem there are any options available either place. And that was the message he had to give at the same time that he was trying to create a better morale on the part of the American people, speaking from the Oval Office, as other presidents have done. We'll talk to a presidential historian about how these things have worked in the past and what the situation is now. But we'll also cover just a lot of information and a lot of territory about what's happening with regard to ISIS and, again, lone wolves here.
Okay, looking forward to that. Timely discussion at 1 o'clock, To the Point with Warren Almy. And coming up on this program, our critics' take on the new season of Transparent and how Homeland has become uncomfortably relevant. TV is next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Fans of Transparent, well, don't make any plans this weekend because the full second season drops on Amazon this Friday. Amazon has already released the first episode to rave reviews. So can Transparent avoid the sophomore slump that infects so many other TV shows? Joining us to talk TV is June Thomas, culture critic for Slate. Hi, June.
Hey, Madeline.
And Michael Schneider, Chief Content Officer for TV Guide Magazine and co-host of KCRW's The Spinoff.
Hello,
Michael.
Hello.
Okay, let's start with this, Transparent Season 2. Here's a clip from Season 2, and it's a family photo session gone awry.
What is he saying?
He says chin up a little bit. But you look beautiful. Oh, that's good. Just a little bit down.
Reggie, okay. You want my head up or you want my head down?
I think chin up for you, sir.
That's a head.
I'm sorry. Chin up.
Laura.
Miss?
He said chin up.
Chin up.
Did he call me sir?
Yes. Just
Okay, we're done.
Okay, so we find the Pfefferman clan still navigating these familial issues surrounding the transparent parent, the transgender woman. June, you've seen season two. What do you think?
I loved it. I mean, it's you started with that excerpt, which is in some ways the worst thing to spend time with, which is the Pfeffermans. They're annoying. They're crazy. They're so maddening. And yet there is something so wonderful about seeing them struggle to figure themselves out. You know, they're really engaging with the world. They're trying to self-actualize. They're not just, they've not given up. And as difficult as it sometimes is to spend time with them, I love seeing that. And I also love how seriously the creators of the show, Jill Soloway particularly, really takes this. And for all of, you know, it's a comedy, it's a half-hour show, which means it's a comedy, but I never feel that things are being made fun of. They're just like, some things are funny, but they're not, there's nothing exploitative about the show, and I appreciate that.
What I like about that clip that you just played is that that's from the opening episode, actually the opening scene of the first episode back, and it's the entire family is gathered for a wedding, so you see all the characters with each other, interacting with each other. And as we know, you know, Transparent's famous, of course, for Jeffrey Tambor, who won the Emmy for playing a transgendered woman, and so that's sort of been the focus of what people talk about or written about this show. But every character is so richly developed, and especially in season two, we see each character still struggling with their identity, with who they are, you know, even in that opening episode. And so the show is able to explore all of these characters, not just Jeffrey Tambor's character, but all of them so richly. And, you know, it truly is one of the best shows on TV right now.
Now, a lot of shows have this so-called sophomore slump where the second season doesn't do as well as the first season. This one...
Well, I got to say, not this year, Madeline. This has been a huge year for sophomore shows. Some really great shows that you know opened well last year. You know, last year was a really groundbreaking year for television for a lot of different reasons. So a lot of those shows now are in their sophomore years, and many of them are not only fulfilling the promise of those first years, but they're actually improving. Transparent being one of them, but there are a number of shows that are really having great seasons, including the comedies Fresh Off the Boat and Blackish on ABC, which instead of having sophomore slumps, have really sort of figured out who they are, and you know, they've become comfortable with their own skin and have turned into really great comedies.
And The Leftovers, prime example.
Leftovers, which finished its second season last night, and curious now if it'll continue beyond this, because it really sort of had a perfect ending that if The Leftovers was not to continue after last night's episode, I think we'd actually kind of be okay with it. But yeah, The Leftovers is a show that the critics were on the fence on season one, but season two sort of, you know, the show really figured out what it was and, you know, really coalesced, and the critics have been raving. It's on a lot of people's top 10 lists this year.
I'd love to add some other dramas that have had really great second seasons. Jane the Virgin on the CW and iZombie on the CW. Jane the Virgin especially, it's a very complicated show. It's a melodrama. It's a soap opera or a version of a soap opera. And having introduced the characters and set a lot of balls spinning, they're now really able to focus. People have told me it's one of the most accurate representations of motherhood and being a first-time mom and a working mom. And I think that's wonderful to have something that's realistic in what is a, I guess the term is heightened realism show. I also think Fargo on FX has been even better in the second season. It got a lot of praise for its first season, but I have liked the second one even better. It seems a little less crazed.
And just as bloody, or maybe bloodier.
Possibly yes. Bloodier.
Okay, let's talk about Homeland. That's had its ups and downs. Here's a trailer for last night's episode.
I have to figure out what happened to Quinn. He just disappeared.
We give the UN Security Council 24 hours.
Once I overheard about an attack in Berlin.
What sort of attack?
I can help stop this thing.
She's lying.
Is she?
Got something to tell me, cousin?
I have some questions.
Fire away.
Who is this group? Do we know?
Okay, lots of action there about, I guess, a possible terror attack coming to Berlin.
Well, a lot of action in the series this season. And what's been really fascinating about Homeland this year is they've managed to sort of throw everything in the kitchen sink in. Whatever's in the headlines right now is on this show, including hacking, Edward Snowden, Russia, of course, Middle East terrorism, Germany's in there. I mean, it's sort of everything that you can imagine in the headlines right now, and it somehow manages to work. It's the most fun I think I'm having right now with TV.
Yeah, I think a character even says talks about preventing the next Paris. So talk about relevant. June, what do you think?
I agree completely. I also was struck by that mention of Paris last night. And a couple of weeks ago, in fact, the episode after the Paris attack, they had to write one of those pre-roll cards saying that, hey, this is a coincidence. We're so sorry. We feel very bad about what happened in Paris. This is fiction. But it was kind of great that they were so on top of the sort of the zeitgeist that they were a little too close to reality.
I mean, clearly the writers of Homeland, they've got some really great advisors and they're really on top of things. And this show has been known to almost predict actual world events.
Yeah, I wonder, though, if that's an asset or a curse from the point of view of the TV viewer, because since we are bombarded with reality, very grim reality in the news, do we want to relive it again in a drama?
Well, there's a little bit of wish fulfillment there, too, because, you know, if you would love a real life Saul to actually be, you know, out there, on the case or a Carrie Matheson. You want to believe that the actual folks from the CIA who are out there doing the work that they do are as on top of it, as perceptive as those characters are.
I think there's also that dreaming of resolution too. There was a lot of upset last season when Homeland just kind of came to an end without resolution. And I'm pretty certain that they won't be doing that this season. Although, hey, I could be wrong about that too.
All right. Well, let's hope you're not wrong. And thanks for coming on today. June Thomas, culture critic for Slate, and Michael Schneider, chief content officer for TV Guide magazine and co-host of KCRW's The Spinoff. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for us today. Keep it right here on KCRW to tune in to Warren Olney and To The Point coming up at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.